Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I'm just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. Craig will not be able to join us tonight, but Kirk and myself will be here to try and teach you guys something, hopefully, or help you understand things a little better. How's it going, Kirk?
Yeah, it's great, Jamie. Good to see you. Good to talk to you, I should say.
I'm going to apologize in advance. We had something blew in last week, and it's got my allergies going crazy. So if my voice is a little raspy or you hear me coughing in the background, I'm sorry. That's just where I'm at right now. I've been congested all week, and like I said, something blew in, and my allergies are going nuts. So just if you hear that in the background, I'll try and keep, cover the mic when I'm coughing and stuff, but it may happen. It sneaks up on me. But what we thought we would do tonight was, rather than try and continue where we were last week, we wait for Craig to come back and continue that. And what we wanted to do was talk a little bit about our own translation processes, how we go about it, the tools we use, and how we come to what we get. So we thought that would be an interesting way to go for tonight, kind of give people a guide, so to speak. A lot of what I will be talking about you can find in a couple of videos that are posted on my site where I kind of walk through how I use Logos. So if you go to yahwahbereth.com and look under translating, there's a Logos walkthrough. So you can find a lot of that information there. Though those videos are both sort of out of date. I've learned a lot more since then, and there's things that I do differently now. So there may be some things I'll talk about tonight that aren't in those videos. But they're a good source still to get started. I mean, Logos is one of those tools, in translating in general, is one of those things where the more you do it, the more you learn and the better you get. So what I know now and what I know 5 years ago are two different things, and what I'll know 5 years from now is going to be even more. So that's where we're at with that. So I thought, Kirk, you should I'd let you take the start of this and kind of walk through what you use, because you don't use Logos. You use a lot more freely available tools, which most of the audience has probably got access to, whereas Logos can be a bit of a costly investment for some. So why don't you talk about a little bit about how you do your...
5 years ago, JV, it was the first time I turned on a computer all by myself. So I've been slow to this table. And Logos is scary looking to me. I mean, overwhelmed. I would probably be overwhelmed by it all. So, and when I started, I wanted to do more than just look up a few words in Strong's, and I didn't know what to do, because even when I bought a few lexicons, or Terry bought a bunch of lexicons for me, and I picked up an interlinear in a bookstore. And basically, a lexicon is like a Hebrew-English dictionary. And an interlinear has all the verses in order with strong numbers, if you can, with strong numbers attached so that you can look them up individually and see how it reads in Hebrew. The problem I had, and I when I started calling in and talking with Craig and with y'all on the Friday show is it took me forever, you know, looking up this book from this book to this book and putting a post-it note here and a post-it note there. So it was a tough way to go. But if you don't need to, you can certainly do it all by hand if you don't need to do it on any particular timeline. But I was trying to figure out a way, so I bravely went in on the computer and I found some sites to that help, and I'll share those with you in a few minutes. But what I wanted to go to first is that when people ask me, and I do get a lot of questions from people, both email and phone, and when I encounter someone that's in the family, we talk about this. And what I do, what I find that was the most helpful before I began to try to translate or at least look up the words, I had already started out, I had already read Question and Paul, Intro to God, and also Yada Yah. So I had a pretty good perspective, or a correct perspective as I would call it, on what I was looking for, what I was reading. And I kind of could, it's like a whole bunch of crooked sticks laid down in one straight one. You can, once you know that certain things are true, like Yahweh's name instead of Lord, and things of that nature, that Shamar does not mean obey or to keep something, and Torah means teaching and things like that. Once you've established those in your mind and looked those up, then the rest of it, you can kind of tell when you're being duped or when something is not right. So
the more truth you learn, the easier it is to spot the lies.
Yeah, very much. And you will get there rather quickly just by reading. Plus, you know, because of the way that C.W. writes, he always gives you the words in parentheses as well as the meanings. Most of the time it's an all-encompassing meaning. It may mean a lot of things besides just that one, and you have to pick the right meaning for that in the context of how the word is used. And you'll also find what I find so enjoyable about C.W. is he will, if it's a question of whether it could easily be this way or that way, or if he's not 100% sure, he'll give you both. And
he'll explain why you
notice
prefer
you do
one
that
over
too.
The other.
Right.
Yeah.
And
not sure. There are sometimes I'm like, I'm about 80% sure this is what's being said, but, you know, I don't want to say that 100%, and, you know, it can preclude someone from understanding something that could have been gained from the alternative translation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll include both of them.
Right. And that's a great habit to get into, and I appreciate that in both of y'all when y'all do that, because then I can explore both and come to my own conclusion as well. So, besides a few of the textbooks, or besides rather some of the lexicons that I have, and one online site, I wanted to talk before I get into that just about what I found about the Hebrew language itself. And I was talking to someone today, I was talking to Jackie actually today, and about the difference between a concrete and a philosophical language. And she asked me to explain it a little better. And basically, a modern Western thought, languages like Greek and Latin and on to English, are all philosophical. The Hebrew, the ancient Hebrew, is a concrete language, and that simply means that all the words are rooted in the five senses. They will not say things like love or praise or those type of things because they are not defined by the five senses like taste, sight, hearing, touch, or smell. And I'll give you an example for praise, which is halah, H and an L, a hay and a lamb. When that first appears about 3,200 years ago, it's written with a person standing with their arms raised. Most of us are familiar with hay and a lamb or a shepherd's staff. Now, the parent root, H-L, is two L's in praise, the one that's translated praise. God never asked anyone to praise him, by the way. But it is translated that way. And as a man looking up and beholding, that's the henna, beholding, and a shepherd's staff that is used to guide the sheep or to guide the family. Now, the concept you might ask, well, where is he guiding us? Well, that's down the path along the way, guided by signposts along the way, Zion. And the place we're trying to go is to reach the home. So that's all encompassed in that word. And it's not about praise. It's about looking up, looking towards something, an actual thing, and being guided. That's what the Torah is guiding and teaching. And then back in the old days, of course, the people knew where the North Star was, and they would orient themselves to that for guidance on a journey. Now, the Hebrews, on the other hand, they used more where east was, the sun, came up every morning, and they oriented that way. But most of us, or most of the nations of the world, guide by thing. But in any case, you're talking about being guided by a light, which I think is a pretty cool metaphor when you think about it, because Yahweh was always talking about light, and he equates himself.
Well, and really, you can almost look at, you know, the hey and the lamed as, you know, speaking of, you know, instead of praise, it's recognizing his ability to guide and lead.
Yeah.
That's not praise. That's just recognizing something.
No.
Recognizing
not at
that
all.
He has the ability to lead us and guide us. And it's acknowledging that.
But if you're an English king or a preacher with a big ego, praise is...
You've got an agenda.
You got an agenda. And those are the type of things you have to kind of look for when you're looking up these words and saying, well, why do they say that? Because every lexicon you go to, and tell me if I'm wrong, JB, but every lexicon you go to is primarily produced for a Christian audience or a rabbinical audience or Catholic, that's Christian too, but I'm in a different slant there as well.
Yeah.
So they're going to exploit what they want you to hear. And the first thing on the list is going to be the one they use, like obey or praise or worship or prayer.
Well, and you know, all of those lexicons are put out by the same publishers that put out the English translations. So it's in their best interest for the lexicon to reflect the translation. If the translation says praise, and their lexicon never says praise, people are going to question it. So they have to include however they translated it.
Yeah. But you're allowed, you have a brain, you have an asama, and you can say, now, wait a minute, I know that's not true. And if you go back as far as you can with what we know about the Hebrew language, we know that that's not a term we'd use because praise would be a philosophical word. And you can say, well, what does that mean? And you'd be right. It's a feel-good thing. It's a something cerebral, not associated with any of your five senses. So immediately I would be starting to look for something else to be more accurate on what Yahweh would have said, because he talked in Hebrew and only talked in Hebrew. So that's the
kind of language he created, so there's got to be a reason
for us to communicate with him and vice versa. He never communicated any other language, so it behooves us to do that. So that is that was helpful to know as I began this quest, I also, a lot of people don't realize that there's only a maximum of about 8,000 to 12,000 words in Hebrew. So it's not as overwhelming. I don't know whether you're familiar with how many words there are in English. But the last time I looked, it was something like 480,000 words in English. And that's a lot to keep track of, and a lot in a thesaurus and a dictionary. So it is a complicated language. As I pursue that a little bit more...
There's not nearly as much repetition in Hebrew, whereas in English we have so many words that mean the exact same thing. In Hebrew there are a handful of words that, you know, they do have other words that mean the same thing, but they always carry a subtle nuance. And so when you use one or the other, yeah, they're not entirely interchangeable. They're not, you know, completely synonyms, but they're similar words. Whereas in English we have words that are, you know, synonyms. I say this or that, it means the same thing.
And you're supposed to, know what that means.
An economy of language.
Mm-hmm. So I find that more comforting for me because there's not as much to have to figure out. But something else about this that I wanted to pursue was the fact that I'm not sure whether it's, maybe you can tell me whether the chart of ancient Hebrew, and there's ancient Hebrew and then there's Paleo Hebrew, the type that was developed in Babylon, where they couldn't, you know, if you try to cut a letter into a clay tablet, it's very hard to make round letters. So it became a little more graphic as far as, you know, triangular or squarish. So the letters started to change. And then we got to the block letters as a third a third type development, I guess, morphed into that. And then the rabbinical, the rabbis decided that it was certain names like Yahweh's name is too holy. I don't know why you'd use holy. That's pagan. But regardless, it was too difficult or too precious to use.
Yeah, they didn't want to mispronounce it.
Or pronounce it. So they chose to make you mispronounce it. And the same thing on any, it seemed like any little letter they wanted, they, if you can change all this and act it like there's no vowels. How could Yahweh talk? Now, we know that ancient Hebrew letters were available in Egypt because we're finding them on stuff in archaeologists today. There's a lot of stuff there that goes way back. So 3,200 plus years beyond. And if... how would Yahweh be able to talk to Moshe without being able to make a vowel sound?
Yeah.
He could.
Well, and how would Moshe have known vowels? What to write down?
Yeah, or what. So all those kinds of
things. If there were no vowels, how did he know what to write down?
Yeah. So some of this stuff is so obvious yet so stupid, and I fell for it like everybody else for years and years and years. But on the pictographs, as an artist, I think they're just really cool. And I decided I can't learn this language very good, as well as I'd like to, but one thing I could do is I recognize the letters because they are pictures, they're called pictographs, and they, not only do all the letters mean something, rather than just a sound, they also have a meaning, and multiple meaning. That's conveyed, that's another nuance of information that we get when we convert, when we are translating, because you can look at the actual individual letters and see what is conveyed by those. And sometimes it's quite astounding. Sometimes it's simplistic, but it doesn't matter. It's still, it's a whole other level on every little part that you go, whether it's the words, whether it's the grammar, which I'm not good at, and but the pictographs and all themselves are, I think it's just cool. I mean, I look at them as another layer when I look at a word. In fact, what you sent me this week that you'll be talking about later, I looked up a few of those as well just to see, like I normally do. But let me share with you what I use, because it's readily available to anyone. Now, I have a few things I want to order, a few more lexicons that you mentioned, JB, in your the word book and so forth, the theological word book and all. And those are terrific. And
yeah, that's a very nice one. You do get a lot of religious rubbish in it, but it mm-hmm. does a really good job of breaking down the word and the origin of the word and what words were derived from it or what words it was derived from. The theological word book of the Old Testament I found to be a very useful tool.
There is
a lot of religious rubbish in it.
Uh-huh. Well, if you got your head screwed on straight, that you should be able to get through that, and at least you should
use your filter.
Wait a minute. That doesn't make sense. What I have been using. Here was the problem. The biggest problem was that I have also some lexicons that don't have any Strong's numbers. Now, I like Strong's numbers because he put a number to every Hebrew word. And
yeah,
you have
that's
that
the one good thing about Strong's, really.
Yeah. And
a lot of the other lexicons will key to it. So if you have a Strong's number, you can look it up in these other lexicons easily.
Right.
Especially if you're on a computer.
Yeah, and you just pop on that, and all of a sudden it goes from here to there. I mean, if you get to another site and it has the number, you can look that up, or you can do searches by it and everything. So the problem I had is I could not read this little small print in the interlinear because it's so many words, and it's such little print in there, it just became a nightmare to do. So what I found is a place which I find great irony in is BibleHub.com. Now, BibleHub, if you're not aware of it, BibleHub is a Bible site. It's got the Torah in it. It's got the Westminster Leningradish Codex in it, which is the Masoretic text. And it is if you just use the things that I use, you don't have too much trouble until you have a few odd words that you have to deal with individually. But the beauty of that one is it has, when... when you say, okay, I'm going to do Psalm 23, and you go to that, you'll have everything. You have three options when you go to the site. And I'm going to explain it because I think a lot of people, as first-timers and all, that are looking for help, this may be the easiest and is certainly the least expensive way to go. And I think it's a pretty good site. You go to when you go to, Psalms 23, on the top of it is going to have a thing called lexicon, and you can hit on that, and it'll have the basic words in a column to that psalm. It'll have the Hebrew word and how to pronounce it, as well as the Hebrew, modern Hebrew writing letters. It'll also tell you what part of speech it is. And it will, and there again, at the I think next to it, it'll tell you what the verbs are, what's related to it. So if it's a noun, it'll tell you where the verb is, so you can click on that verb. Because, as you'll verify, that most all the Hebrew words are defined by their verbal action. Is that correct?
Very few. I can't even think of one off the top of my head where the noun is the root. Usually, noun is derived from the verb. Yeah, it's a very active language, like you said, concrete and active. So an action, becomes a noun. So, jump became jumper. Yes, one who jumps. So the action preceded the name, which would make sense in any type of concrete language. If someone did something, they called that name, then it became a noun for someone who does that.
Mm-hmm. So even on a site that supposedly is very Christian, if you're just looking at the Masoretic text, you can find out a tremendous amount of, tremendous source of information there. Next to the little part that says lexicon, there's another one called Hebrew. And what that is this text analysis. You hit on that one, you'll have the same verse come up. And it will have every word, every preposition, I mean, everything that's there will be in the order that is written, and you'll find even more information. So sometimes on the simplistic one, they'll drop a few prepositions or a few conjunctions or something like that. And as you know, like the sheet that you sent me this week, the owl is pretty important, or, you know, all these different little connected words, or if you don't look those up too. So that's important. But so I start with the first one, and then I go to the second one. And then if I want to read the interlinear completely in the way that it's done, which is a little awkward because the subject sometimes precedes object and backwards to the way we do it. But still, it's there for your examination. And once again, you can look up a tremendous amount of information. What you'll find in there also is that you'll see Strong's lexicon. You'll have the NASB lexicon, the New American Standard lexicon. And then one that I really like a lot is the Brown's, Drivers, and Briggs. And you use that one too, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. So that one is in there, so you can compare those three before you have to go to your hard. Before I have to go to my hardcover books, and I also so armed with that, it's a pretty easy row to hoe for me, because I can at least see everything that y'all are talking about, and have it looked up rather easily. It takes a while because I'm slow, but it's really fun. And then I cross check that with the ancient Hebrew lexicon that I have, and I've got a whole bevy of stuff, and I have only found about three times, JB, when something that you translated or something that Craig has translated where I couldn't find what y'all were talking about. And two times I finally found it in the German one, the Jensensus, what is the Hebrew Aramaic lexicon. I found it there on two of them, and one of them was because I didn't have those other books that you talk about, that like theological reference books. So that's a pretty, of all the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of words, that's a pretty good record. Now, let me, if I can, right before I turn it over to you, let me show you one thing. I did one little verse of something just to show you the difference between how concrete, other words are more concrete versus the way the Christian translators will do it. And I chose a seven-word verse, which is Psalms 103:8. Basically, it starts out with Lord. So you look up Lord, the first word, and of course, amazingly, it has in Hebrew, it has Yahweh. Of course, we know is Yahweh. That's how you spell in Hebrew his name. So we know he's not the Lord. And if we've been reading, we know that we've already looked up Baal or Baal, and we know that's Satan's title. So we know Lord is wrong, so I immediately changed that to Yahweh. And if you want to look it up, 3068 is the number of the Strong's numbering system, and it's the proper noun, obviously, for the God of Yisrael. And then it'll tell you, on my little system here, it'll tell you that, okay, there's also a verbal root, and that is Hayah. And Hayah, of course, is to exist, and it exists eternally. But it's also in the ancient Hebrew, it means to breathe, because you have to breathe in order, and when you stop breathing, you stop living, so you stop existing. So, I mean, it's no magic here. It's just you look and say, oh, okay, that's what it is. If anybody tells you otherwise, I got a problem, because you can't twist this. And then it says, the Lord is compassionate. Now, there's a problem, because compassion is not a concrete word. It's a philosophical word. So
it's subjective.
Yeah. So, I mean, whatever's compassionate to you may not be compassionate to me. So the word in Hebrew becomes rakum, and it's an adjective. And rakim is, I think it's the verb on there, but it's passions. And you study the word and you find out that it is passions, but it means the things that are felt in the inner stomach area. It means to be sympathetic and to be understanding. But interestingly, in the ancient Hebrew, it's being sympathetic and understanding, but protecting from harm. And then I looked up the letters, and you have a Rosh and a Chet and a Wah and a Mem. And you have man facing the right direction, the correct direction, going from right to left at defense. Chet is a fence that protects you. And we're trying to be, as we go towards being enlightened, enlarged, enlightened, increased, and by the set-apart spirit, which is usually referenced in the word M. So you get those little bitty clues in there which help you define those words so that you've got a good handle on what you're reading. And then in the English it goes on and it says the next one is compassionate and gracious. Well, I'm sure you have the same issue I have with that one, because we know that gracious is the English word from a Latin word, gratia, which is the three little naughty girls on the three graces. And so that's not it. So you look up that number and you hit on that, and it says kanun, which is an adjective. And you immediately, if you know Yao Kana's name, that means Yah is merciful. And the verb, of course, is kanan, which is to show mercy or to show favor. In addition, it also means protective, to be providing a rescue or a help to one in distress. And you have that is written in letters of a chet, a nun, a wa, and a nun. Now, the chet is always a fence that separates. We're being kodeshed. We're being separated from danger. We're being set apart from the world to Yahweh. So all that's implied in there. The nun, of course, is a continuous thing. We're talking about the sperm, so we're talking about a family and the family that is increased. And it's increased because we have a wall, which means to increase. That's how you increase the tent size, by using a wall or a tying the widening the canvas or the in those cases when been furs by using a peg and put in the ground. And then, of course, the last word was another nun, so it's more emphatic. So that's pretty easy to find. So I would immediately say, okay, we ain't talking compassion. We ain't talking gracious, even though I have a feeling what that means in English. That's not what he said. And then you go, and it says it'll be slow to anger, and the word for slow is erech, which just means patience, long suffering, or to lengthen. And it also means the verbal root erech is to endure. Well, where it has to endure, because in order to be Yisrael, the ra in it is serah, which means to endure and persevere. So that's all compatible. So I would probably change that from slow to anger, or just, well, that'd be fine, but patience is a better word, and enduring patience would be a better word, or capable of calmly awaiting a favorable outcome is also the meaning of it. So off is anger. Well, anger is not something you can define concretely. So what the Hebrews use is a word called aph. A-P-H is the way we pronounce it. It's an aleph and a pay, which is the letter is used as a P or a P-H. And it means nostril. It also means flared nostril. It means nose and the face. And the longer definition would be a quick-tempered, angry, heavy breathing, rapid breathing, a reddened face, and to be enraged. And the verbal root there is anaph, which is to be angry or to become angry. So if you go back to the English now, we've got, instead of gracious and slow to anger, we've got a little clearer understanding of what anger is defined as. And then abounding. Now, this is an interesting one. The next word is abounding. The actual word that they translated abounding is rab, R-A-B, and it's a rosh and a bet. Much, many, great, abundance, increase greatly. It's the word used or adopted by the rabbis because they wanted to be abundant in authority and teaching and wisdom. From a verbal root again, you can look that up, and it's a rab, rabab, to be or become much or many, multiplied and numerous, which is what we're trying to be because we that's the whole point of being, after you've been adopted in Makrum, is we want to be enlightened and empowered. So, and the English goes on to say, so instead of a slow to anger and abounding in mercy. And mercy, of course, you're familiar with that one, that's chesed, which is goodness, which is the word for good is tob, and tob is defined in ancient Hebrew as being functional, walking down the path and being that is intended, that was intended for your life, is an easy definition for tob or good. So chesed is kindness, it's mercy, remember, righteousness, which is tzedek, and is pictured as a interestingly enough, his pictures add, once again, the fence, which is a chet, and followed by a man lying on his side, which is a tassad. So you have chesed as tassad, and with those two letters, and that's a man resting because he can rest now because he's protected by the fence. So if I was trying to check this against what I'm reading in a normal English dictionary, or a normal English Bible, rather, I would be pretty good shape. I know there's some tough ones in there. You have to dig a lot deeper than I normally do. But I don't think there's anyone out there that wants to do this that couldn't at least, if they're confused about a verse or they want to follow along with CW, this would be the way to go, I think. So, in any case, that's about all I got, JB.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. I actually learned a lot. I love the whole conversation about concrete versus philosophical language, especially when you look at, virtually every philosophy of man is intent on disproving God or making God irrelevant. No wonder they carry philosophical languages. It was all about, trying to render God, useless. You look at a concrete world, you can't deny a God. But if you start philosophizing about it, now you can justify anything.
It's hard to twist these words. If you see it in print, and remember, Yahweh says in the Torah as well as Yahusha was claimed to have said, don't change a jot and a tittle. The reason I went back to the ancient Hebrew to begin with is because if he said don't change, if that was the original language, and we find it in Egypt from going out from Moses, and you've changed that much, they don't even look like anything close to what they originally looked like.
Yeah.
why would I give that up? He must have said it for a reason. He must have wanted me to use it. And if you have something that simple and everything is concrete where you can see it, you can taste it, smell it, feel it, etc., then it's very hard to twist that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was what I loved about your whole the one show you were talking about, the whole thing with Tobe and Ra. You know,
right.
Good and bad being more, you know, works as intended and doesn't work as intended.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I thought was a great way of looking at, in a concrete way, looking at what is good and what is bad. You know, if it works as intended, it's good. If it doesn't, it's bad.
Well, it's not like evil. You have all kind of conversations. You know, and maybe even some things are quite good for most of us. You could say,
well, I've
you
been called evil for denying Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You know,
you're walking down the right path, the way you were designed to be, or dysfunctional, raw. And raw is written, which is funny. Raw, you know, is written as a head with two eyes. That's man's perspective. Tobe is an upright pole. Yeah, so going towards a house to be. So when you look at it that way, he's giving you every clue in the world to help you. I mean, I don't know what do you need. Obviously, I needed the Shemar Torah a lot earlier in my life when my head was a sharp
thing. Yeah, it's all there. You just have to be willing to invest the time. Yeah, I find the ultimate irony to be, you know, every single source we use for all of our translations and everything we do are Christian sources.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Logo Software, Faith Life is the company. You know, Bible Hub is a Christian-based company.
The irony there.
It's all religious. But, you know, you can use their tools to easily disprove it.
Yeah.
So
I love irony.
So.
Yeah, the funny thing about Bible Hub, you know whose site that is?
No.
That's Craig's old buddy.
Oh, is it?
That's the Jerry Falwell site. That was Jerry Falwell's. So, and I used to say,
when
he had that conversation, you remember the conversation he talks about he had with Jerry Falwell and his head of his department, and they said, they were at least honest to him. They said, you know, you're absolutely right. But we're not going to change it. They won't send money. That is so, I mean, I laugh at it. It's sickeningly funny to me. It's just, I go, my gosh, people.
There was a discussion last week in the chat room about, you know, the population of hell versus the population of heaven in the end. I'm like, you know, we don't really know, but someone said they thought it would be comparable. There'd be about as many people in hell. I think hell's going to be way outnumbered the number of people in heaven. Because you look at all the religious leaders. And to me, to be worthy of hell, you have to have knowingly and actively engaged in leading people away. And that covers every religious leader. That's every pope. You don't rise to that level. Yeah, because, I mean, they go through all sorts of schooling. They have access to all sorts of material. You don't get to that level without having had the opportunity to learn that you're wrong. And even if you don't know that you're wrong, you're presenting yourself as a leader. When you don't know you're wrong, but you don't know you're right, that almost would be worse to present yourself as a leader when you don't know.
Yeah, how dare you?
So, yeah. Every religious leader is going to be in hell, I think. I mean, they know. They have access to this material. They know. There is no way they cannot know. They're putting out the material that we're using to show them they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't.
Well,
there's no way. Maybe your average small town pastor who's, you know, just the only guy there that went to college, though they put him as a pastor, maybe he doesn't know. Yeah, you know, he didn't spend the time. I don't know, but you know, when you get into these mega churches and they know. They have access to the knowledge if they want to do it.
Their conscience may not allow them to go there because it'll just tear them up, so they just wash over it. But the people around them, there's somebody there that knows. People around Billy Graham knew. I mean, he hired scholars to write his books. I mean, they knew, and so they just like the Bible.
One of the most eye-opening reads I had was, it's a great book, and I would recommend it for anyone interested, is
Philip Comfort's Encountering the Manuscripts. Mm-hmm. It is the greatest argument for why you should not trust the Greek text. I mean, he goes through and meticulously dictate, you know, shows you how these texts were altered, how there was no belief that they were scripture and how they were, you know, felt free to change them. He shows you all this stuff and why you shouldn't trust it, and then ends with, they're 100% inspired by God. Your book convinced me of the complete opposite of what you are trying to tell me.
Yeah.
There's no way he actually believes that, but he knows that his book will not sell if he does not present that. And so now he can claim that. Christians can claim that, oh, well, see, he did all this research and he concluded this. And so, you know, it's a circle jerk, to use the term.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like I said, that's a great book. You will come to a conclusion that the Greek texts are not reliable at all. There's no other conclusion you can draw from that book. How he doesn't draw that conclusion... It's willful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me, as a fellow scholar trying to figure out some of this stuff, when you're reading these things, and most of my sources will tell me this is a verb or this is an adjective or something like that, but and I have my Hebrew charts where I've taken out of my How to Speak Hebrew grammatical sections. You know, this is the hippol or the hoppol or whatever. On your program, when you're doing this and on Logos, does it tell you that this is written in the hippol stem, or is that in that, or do you go to a different source to find that?
No, I use my primary source for the translations is the Anderson Forbes Analyze text, and what it is basically it's the Masoretic, but they went through and analyzed the words. And put in, okay, it's a verb or it's an adjective in this form. It's in, it has this stem or this conjugation. They put all that into that one.
I'm a hit and miss on those things. So it's
I cheat because I've tried reading through and learning the grammatical rules, and I'm just about as bad with Hebrew grammar as I am with English grammar and trying to remember all that.
So as long as you have the source that you can check it, then you can make sure that they're telling you the truth, and then you can rely on it. So,
yeah.
Is that something that most
of us... Well, that's nice. It'll tell me this is in the hippol stem. Well, I can click on this book, and it'll tell me what the hippol stem means, and then I can look at this book, and it tells me how to tell whether something, it's in the hippol stem if the middle letter is doubled. I'm not sure if that's exactly right for the hippol, but that's one of them. Like, the middle letter of the word gets doubled. That means it's in this stem. Or, it's got this that tabbed onto the end, that means it's in the jussive. So, I've got one book that'll tell me, how to check that, and another book that tells me what it means.
Can you buy those separately, in hardcover or on a disc or something? And do you how do we get hold of that book? We have to be in Logos.
Sure. I know there are certain books in my library that are only Logos available. The Dictionary of Biblical Languages, for example, is a Logos product.
Hardcover. I think it's available.
They have that hardcover. I know at one point I had looked and they didn't have that one. But I know most of them are, like the Brown Driver Briggs I use, Gaius Hebrew Aramaic Lexicon, Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, and I'm pretty sure most of the grammars I use, I'm trying to think of names now, Justinius Hebrew Syntax is one of them. And there's a list of them on my site, the books I use most commonly. I think most all, if not all, are available in hardcover, some of them at very high prices. I know at one point I looked for the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, and a hardcover copy was going to be $150 or something.
Wow.
But I even paid, I think for that one, I paid $55 on Logos for it.
Yeah. So, well, if
and I've kind of built my library over
time. Send me one just so I can look around and then I can share it with other people on if they're looking for that as well. But I appreciate it. Anything on the grammar that will help me where I'm reading it, I'm saying, okay, I think that's in the hippol stem, or I think I'd like to be.
One of my next projects for the website when I finish the, it was originally supposed to be about a 20-30-page article on circumcision, and at this point I'm at 168 pages, and I'm maybe halfway through.
So once I finished this project,
you're going to be as bad as Craig.
What I'm trying to do, what I decided I wanted to do was I originally was going to just take my notes I had done for the shows I'd done on circumcision in the past and expand on that and kind of create a little more of an article about that. But what I decided to do as I got going was just to go to every single verse where mool is used, and then every single verse where aral is used, and, you know, examine, you know, okay, what does God have to say on this subject? And so that's what I've been doing, and I'm almost through. I'm in the last passage right now with mool, and then I'll go back and do aral. And like I said, I'm about 168 pages now. So it's kind of grown into a lot more than I planned, and it's taken me several years. But I've also got to where, you know, my process has changed a bit as I went. So I'm going to go back and re-edit it a bit, because there were a couple spots where I would go straight to just the passage. And I've learned that you know, one of the things, context is king. You know, you cannot just jump right into a verse. And so I've started going back and doing whole passages. And then I'm learning so much as I'm doing it that I'm like, I can't not share this. So you know, a lot of what's in this article is going to be way more than just about circumcision. It's about anything and everything I learned while covering these passages.
Yeah.
So, but then after that, I do want to write up an article on Hebrew grammar. I got a cheat, you know, Craig shared his little cheat sheet he used to keep on hand. I'll put that up on the site, but I want to expand on that and get more in depth. So that's going to be on the projects for the future.
Yeah.
That was actually where I was kind of wanting to start was before I even got into my translation process, kind of talk a little bit about how my process has changed. So, I originally started translating, it's probably been 10, 12 years now. I'm not sure even. I can't remember when it was, but it was before Questioning Paul or Introduction to God. And, yeah, so the only thing I had was, you know, yada yada, and I've been reading through that and listening to the, you know, at the time there were the audio versions. So this was the very first draft of yada yada. And, you know, I was learning all this stuff, and I'm like, okay, you know, this is really interesting. This makes total sense. But how do I know he's right? And so, yeah, we just gotten married, so I was, you know, a lot younger. We didn't have a kid. We didn't have a house. We were living in a little one-bedroom apartment. So we had a little more disposable income back then, and so I talked my wife into letting me buy logos because that was what Craig was using. And so I'm like, okay, we use these sources. And it seemed like, you know, a good idea. And I think the original package I got was about $450. They don't offer it anymore, sadly, but... So that was my initial investment into it, and what I started off doing was rather than trying to jump in and figure out how to translate, I watched several YouTube videos just on how Logos works and what parts of it, you know, what's in it, and what I found was the exegetical guide is the most resourceful thing in there. And you know, not to be a marketing campaign for them, but Logos describes their product as it's like having a research assistant at your fingertips, and that's really what it is. You can do all of it with a book, but it's going to take a lot more time. You're going to have to go find, you know, the passage, flip through this book here, flip through this book here, whereas it just kind of puts it all at my fingertips. So, you know, I do in the exegetical guide, I put in the verse, it brings it up word by word breakdown, tells me what the part of speech is, what the tense is, all of that. But back then, I didn't know anything about the grammar stuff. I wasn't even looking at that. I was just looking at the words. And so I kind of familiarized myself with Logos, and then I was like, okay, let's start checking Craig's translations. So I didn't even try translating anything on my own. I just would open up, you know, and pick out a verse from his, and I would go step by step through it and go, okay, how did he get this? Is he right? And more often than not, it was, yeah, right away. I'm like, oh, no doubt, yeah, there's that. Every now and then I'd come to something, and I'm like, okay, wait, how did he get this one? And then I'd dig a little deeper, and I'm like, okay, there's where he's getting that from, because, you know, he's not looking at, you know, when I click on it, you know, so I take a word and I click on Dictionary of Biblical Languages, it brings me up to what the Masoretic text says is the word. Well, if I scroll up or down, usually you'll see two or three other definitions, and they're the same root word. So in the original Hebrew, it could have been any of those, and the Masoretic ported it one way. So you'd look and go, okay, well, there's how he got that. He used this version of that word instead of that.
and it makes more sense in the context. So I learned and familiarized myself with Logos through that. And then I got the idea to compile everything he had done in order into a document, and then wanted to go through and fill in the gaps. And so I started with Genesis and, you know, had what he had. And so if he was missing a verse or five verses, I would translate those verses and put it into the context of his. And I did that okay. for a while and got to be where I was having so much fun doing it and enjoying it. And I was like, and he had been modifying his translations because he had learned. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to start ignoring his. I'm not going to incorporate them in. I'm just going to translate this all through straight for myself. And so I started translating through, and I think I've made it through about 34 chapters of Genesis. And then I got tied up. I had a change at work, and I was so busy and wore out, and I just didn't get a chance. And so it was about a year or so where I just never had a chance to really work on it. Mm-hmm. And once I finally did get back into doing things again, I kind of reached the point, I was reaching the point even in there, because if you go on to the side and look at my document, you'll notice there's a lot more footnotes near the end than there was at the beginning. I got more and more where I was like Craig, where it was hard for me to translate it without commenting on it. My idea of trying to put out just a translation, I'm like, I can't do that. I got to comment on it. I got to share what I'm learning. And so I've kind of put that on the back burner, and I just started translating things for myself and, you know, helping other people. Someone would be like, you know, well, what's this mean? What's this mean? So I would look at it and examine it. And then, Craig would send me chapters of his stuff. So I was checking his stuff and reading through it. So I didn't get a whole lot done on my own, but I was still working and active in it. So stayed familiar and learned a lot more. That's, you know, when we started learning about all the grammar stuff. And so like, okay, now I got to figure this out. And so where I'm at now is, like I said, I started writing, since I started the website, I'm wanting to add content through more and more articles. And so the one I'm doing now, like I said, is on circumcision. And the way, like I said, I started doing it was I was writing, I'd go to the thing and I'd go a couple verses before the word I was looking at, and then I'd translate it and go. But then I came across one where it was like, I have no idea how to translate this because, I don't know what's going on. So I was like, I had to go back and back. And so then I was like, well, I learned so much. I came to this one, and I can't think of which chapter or what one it was now, but I came to one where I thought this was going to be just kind of a throwaway one because it wasn't really speaking of circumcision in a in-depth way or in a even a physical way. But I was like, I'm going to translate it because it's here. But when I went back and translated everything that led up to it, I was like, I learned so much, and it reinforced the whole point I was trying to make throughout the book. I'm like, I learned so much doing this. I got to do this from now on. And so now that's what I do is I'll go through and, first thing I'll do is I'll go through in an English translation, and I use the, I think it's the ISR, International Scripture Research Institute. And it's not a good translation, but it doesn't use Lord, so it's a little easier to read for me. So I use that one, and I'll go through and read and try and figure out where it looks like the conversation began. Because the chapter verses break down and make no sense. For example, the one we're going to talk about, I went to go look at Jeremiah 9:25 and 26. That's where mool was used. I had to go all the way back to 8:18 to get the beginning of a conversation, and then go most of the way through chapter 10 to finish the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's big chunk of stuff, but I've learned a lot from that other stuff. Once I've determined where it is, so like that one, what?
I said, why don't you take us through that and on your study? That's where we began on the stuff that you sent me, correct?
Yeah. All right. So once I do that, I'll go through and translate that entire passage, not commenting on anything. I'll make a few notes in the margins to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found also is, as I commented, I've changed my translation. So as I'm going through and commenting, I'm changing the translation because, it's that whole thing of, you learn so much of what you, you learn 30% of what you read, 30% of what you hear, and, 40% of, what you teach. And you learn more by teaching other people. So as I'm trying to explain my translations, I'm understanding more about it, and I'm realizing, that shouldn't have been this way, it should have been that way. So So I'll go through and revise my translation as I'm commenting and then go change it at the beginning again so that it reflects what I learned. So, like I said, yeah, we went back here. So the ones I picked out to talk about tonight are Jeremiah 8, 18, and 19. And it's good because it's the start of the conversation, and there's some flaws I found in the English translation that I thought would be really good as examples. So, to start with, so we have the King James rendering, just so you know how they translate it, so you know what I'm talking about when I'm like, well, they translate it this way and I chose this. So it reads, "When I comfort myself against sorrow, my heart is faint in me. Behold, the voice of the cry of the daughter of my people, because of them that dwell in a far country. Is not the Lord in Zion? Is not her king in her? Why have they provoked me to anger with their graven images and with strange vanities?" So that's their rendering. The way I chose to render it is my comfort or comforter. And I'm not going to read the Hebrew words because I can't pronounce them and I don't feel like butchering it. my source of brightness, encouragement, or one who provides encouragement. Because of and concerning sorrow, anguish, and grief, a mental troubling resulting from affliction upon my faint, emotionally weak or ill heart, my inner being, my mind and understanding, my heart and soul, my knowledge and thinking, my reflections and memories, my inclinations and resolutions, my conscience and moral character, my emotions and passions. Behold, the voice of the cry for help of the daughters of my people from lands and regions which are distant, far, in a state of alienation. Is Yahweh not existing in Zion? So the first word is Mabli Gith. And it can mean either comfort or comforter.
So, I looked up these things, by the way. I don't want to interrupt you, but for a second, I looked up these things, and it's all right there, easy to find. So you're in good shape. You didn't mean me to tell you that, but it's
I'm always open to being wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm inclined to see this as Yirmiyah calling out to Yahweh. And so I think calling Yahweh his comforter. But it could be saying my comfort. So he's calling out to Yahweh because he's suffering watching his people continue to disregard Yahweh and the covenant. And he's experiencing this sorrow, and his heart has grown weak. And we'll see later if you continue through this, there's literally a part where, Yirmiyah is talking about wanting to abandon his people. So, I mean, it's pretty bad for him.
Yeah.
So another thing you'll notice is that I rendered the al two different ways in this statement. And al can convey many things. So context is absolutely necessary to determine how it gets rendered. So the first use here, I opted to render it as because of and concerning. The KJV opted for against. Now, both are possible translations of the word. So I'm not saying they're wrong. It's not an inaccurate translation. But I chose not to use against because I don't see how one can be comforted against something. You can't be comforted concerning something, but you can't be comforted against something. That makes no sense to me. So then the second use of all, I rendered it in its most common form, which is as upon. Most often when you see all, it's going to mean upon. Upon this rock, that would be all. The KJV, however, chose to ignore its use here altogether. And the change is subtle but worth noting. By telling us that the sorrow is upon his heart and understanding, the Hebrew view of heart as the inner being, we understand better Yirmiyah's mindset. Which, as I said, will be important later when we see him ready to abandon his people. So, it's a subtle difference, but, it's a word that was there, and we shouldn't ignore it. So, while ignoring all doesn't change the verse, it does influence how we may view the passage as a whole. So, it's important to keep it there. The next part of the statement, I rendered very differently from the KJV. I view it as Yahweh responding. And it says, if her king does not exist in her, why do they vex, agitate, stir up, and provoke my heart to a heated condition, which in turn leads to a specific action? Because of those idols and images, those worship icons, graven or carved images, crosses, and statuary. Because of worthless and foreign idols, meaningless, empty, and futile foreign idols. So the first thing you'll notice is, contrary to most of the English translations, I've chosen to render the first part of the statement in Yahweh's voice and not in the voice of those crying for help. You know, the King James rendered it as, you know, is the Lord not in Zion? Is her king not in her? As being spoken by the same person. Mm-hmm. But right. They're ignoring the use of a word here again. And in this case, it's him at the beginning of the statement. So they ought to translate the statement as though the ha precedes it instead. So in Hebrew, there's no question mark. Yeah, there's no punctuation. So to mm-hmm. note whether something is a question or not, it's a word at the beginning. Different words are placed at the beginning to indicate questions or interrogatives. So in the previous statement, you know, is Yahweh not in Zion? I'm not going to use Lord. Is Yahweh not in Zion? The ha indicates a binary question. That's a question where there's only a yes or no answer. So mm-hmm. you know, it is yes or no. Is Yahweh in Zion? Or is Yahweh not in Zion? So that fits. But the second one used the M. And it's used to indicate a question with a condition. So it's the equivalent of in English asking if. So it would be if her sovereign is not in here. So since there's no dispute that the second part of the statement, which follows, is Yahweh responding, the first part would have to be him as well. Because otherwise there's a condition without any follow through. So you would read, you know, is Yahweh not existing in Zion if her king does not exist in her, period. Well, yeah. If her king doesn't exist in her, what? So, yeah, they ignore that so they can put it into their mouth and not in Yahweh's. And so, yeah, that's a perfect example where just the English translations shouldn't be trusted. Yeah, that word was put there. It means this. And it changes everything. Now this is in Yahweh's mouth. So if her king does not exist in her, and then it goes on. So rather than Yahweh asking a question, he's making a statement by telling us mm-hmm. that their malach, king or sovereign, doesn't exist in her. You know, it's not, you know, he's not asking it because he knows the answer. You know, he's making a statement. His intent mm-hmm. was, you know, Yahweh's intent was for him to be the leader or the malach of Israel.
Right.
So he's answering the cry by stating that he's not with them. What were you going to say?
No, I said absolutely right. It's from the very start, he didn't want a king.
Yeah, he wanted to be their leader. And so he's answering them by saying, you know, I'm not with you. And he goes on to tell them exactly why with the second part. You know, that's where the condition comes in. You know, if you're not there, here's why. So the first part could be summed up as, if you want my help and you know I'm not with you, why do you ka'af? So this is where we're going to get more into it. You know, so far, I haven't really delved a lot into my translation process. I've given you the translation. I've explained certain words. But you know, those were more basic words where you know, you're pretty much going to go, and there's not a whole lot of dispute as to what these words mean. Ka'as, on the other hand, gets a little more in-depth. So I'm going to go into my exact process. I'm going to try and walk you step-by-step as best I can through my mental process as I was translating this verse. So my first stop is to go to... And Craig's talked about this. This is my favorite lexicon or dictionary to use, and that's the Dictionary of Biblical Languages with Semitic Domains Hebrew. And like I said, it's a really excellent one. It breaks things down very well. It gives you many definitions, and it's just a really good resource, in my opinion. So when I open that up, the first thing I find is to be angry, be vexed, be incensed, i.e. be in a state of strong displeasure, anger, provoke to anger or distress. Note, the provocation can be verbal or action-oriented. So that's the definition in that it takes me to when I click on the link. So then I look above and below the words to see if there are any other words with the same root letters. Because remember, you know, there were no vowel pointings in the original text. So this word, you know, if it has the same root letters, it was the same word and could have been there. And so I find that as a noun, you know, this was the verbal forms, but as a noun it means sorrow, grief, a feeling of anxiety and sadness in a distressing situation, anger, fury, i.e. having strong feelings of displeasure and annoyance based on a wrong, real or perceived, to taunt, a speaking of words of scorn, implying anger toward object of scorn with a focus on eliciting a response by the mocking. Provocation, to cause another to be angry by an action. So, you know, what I'm looking for here is not necessarily to get, like, okay, what's this word mean, dictionary definition. What I'm trying to do is gain a better understanding of what the word means so that I can try and figure out how to best convey it in English. I don't want to just take their words and put it there. I want to figure out, you know, what's this, what is the root of this word? I understand as much as I can about the word. And then I can translate it. You know, because language is a tool. Language is a tool to communicate a message. The better I understand the Hebrew word, the better I will be able to translate it into English or convey it into English. So I'm beginning to get a picture of the word at this point and what it's conveying. So, but I always want to dig a little deeper. So my next stop is usually to go to the theological word book of the Old Testament. And there I find that it means be vexed. Indignant, angry, wroth, be grieved, provoked to anger or wrath, and wrath. And with its derivatives meaning, you'll have to bear with me because I'm reading the definitions directly out of it for you so you have that, because I don't want to just tell you what I got from it. You know, the whole idea was I want you to see what I'm going, what I go through. So, the root meaning of ka'os is to vex, agitate, stir up, or provoke the heart to a heated condition, which in turn leads to specific actions. This term, as well as the synonyms for anger and wrath, op, hema, kasap, and aba, see discussions for synonyms at kasap, are used anthropomorphically and anthropopathically of God. They refer to God's inner self as vexed and provoked by rebellion or sin. The term, when applied to God, implies that man can affect the very heart of God so as to cause him heat, pain, or grief to various degrees of intensity. In the call stem, the verb is used 5 times to indicate the state of vexation in men. Thus, King Asa was vexed or exasperated when he was rebuked by the prophet Hanai. Likewise, Sanballat, when he saw the builders at work on the walls of Jerusalem. From these instances, we may gather that the state of vexation is not normally proper for a true child of God. I would completely disagree with this statement. This is where I said, like, the theological word book can be very useful, but it's full of a lot of religious bunk. In fact, Ecclesiastes 7:9 teaches that the child of God should not be hasty in spirit to be vexed. There's a perfect example. Should not be hasty to be vexed. Not that you should not be vexed. There are plenty of things which should cause you to be vexed. Because such vexation rests in the bosom of fools. Yeah, that's hasty vexation. Continuing on, it says, God is said not to continue in this state of vexation when his jealousy is quieted. Ezekiel 16:42. Indeed, vexation is not an abiding attribute of God. Yet his people may provoke him to anger and wrath by their unfaithfulness. Because God is holy and loving, he will only share himself with a people whom he has bound to himself in covenant love, and whom he has taken for himself for fellowship and service. You'll have to excuse me one moment. My daughter has just walked in to say goodnight. Good night, you girl. I love you. Sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah, let's see, where was I?
You were because God is holy and loving, if you will. Yeah. About there, somewhere in there.
Holiness and jealous love is provoked to anger and wrath against them. Thus, he may be deeply vexed, agitated, pained, or grieved by disobedient Israel. This is the general burden of the 45 passages in the Old Testament in which the hiphil stem of the verb is used. Example, Moses warned the Israelites that if their descendants, having been in the promised land, corrupt themselves by making graven images in any form, that, and I'm going to replace the Lord here, Yahweh will be deeply vexed at them. He calls heaven and earth to witness that God, in his vexation, will make them to utterly perish from off the earth, in Deuteronomy 4:25. And here's a good example of why I like to come to the theological word book. I ended up, when I got to commenting on this verse, I went back and translated that entire passage of Deuteronomy because of this reference, because it's literally what I'm reading here is the fulfillment of that prophecy. So I went back and examined that one, and I learned, that's where I find this useful, is it points out other uses of the word, and you can see where it was used in a similar way, so you can use it to make connections. So moving on. Moses speaks also of this, of his fear of God. And, you know, we know that's not true, but when God has been aroused to highly
reverence
faith in Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy 9:1-8, and when God has been continuously and deeply provoked, vexed, grieved, much is required to quiet the heart of God. Example, King Manasseh provoked God so deeply by his pervasive involvement in idolatry, Kings 21:1-26, that when Josiah attempts reforms, Yahweh is not appeased. Judgment had to fall upon Judah, 2 Kings 23:26, a judgment which destroyed many of the people and removed the nation from the promised land. This judgment, in keeping with God's justice, is not contrary to divine love. Rather, it is an expression of divine love which has been offered, rejected, and deeply grieved. Divine love suffers long. It also defends itself and removes the object of its vexation and sorrow. Now, there's an excellent example. You know, I would completely agree with them. So that's why,
well, you know, as you're reading that, it seems to me that the thing that is very obvious and repeats over and over and over throughout the Torah is Yah just is, if you want to grieve him, all you got to do is get involved in religion and politics and idol worship.
Oh, yeah.
When you substitute him.
Straight off.
Yeah. I mean, this is a marvelous detail, but I mean, the bottom thing is when you stop trusting and you start to trust in these other things, he just doesn't understand you. What's wrong with you?
Yeah. You want to anger God, get involved in religion. That's straight way. That's exactly what we're seeing. We'll see in this whole passage in Jeremiah if we made it through all of it. So, but then I'll go and I'll check my other dictionaries or lexicons to see if they match what I'm getting. And in this case, I find that my other lexicons that I use mainly, which are the Enhanced Brown Driver Briggs English Hebrew Lexicon, which is you use, the Justinianus Hebrew Chaldean Lexicon, again, one you use, the Concise Hebrew and Aramaic Lexicon, Strong's, all agree on the basic meaning of this word. So, yeah, I'm not going to include their definitions because they didn't really add much beyond what I already learned. So, but they all basically agree. If they didn't, I would then look, okay, well, why did this one pick this and why did this one not? And usually it's, you know, they're minor differences. And, you know, some of them, what I hate to see is you'll see where it's like, oh, well, we chose this definition because of the similar word in Arabic. Well, Arabic came after Hebrew, so I'm not going to base my understanding. No, they'll actually use Arabic.
Arabic, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen a couple where it's like, well, because a similar word in Arabic means this, so we use that. And I'm like, no. Yeah, Arabic came after Hebrew. I'm not going to use Arabic to understand Hebrew. I will use Hebrew to understand Arabic, but not the other way around. That's usually the only time I really find a lot of differences between these. Usually what I'll find is that the Dictionary of Biblical Languages will actually have definitions that the other ones don't. Yeah, very rarely have I found a definition in the other ones that was not there, which is why it's become my favorite. It's kind of very encompassing. You can tell that they drew a lot from the other lexicons in terms of their definitions and tried to include everything and then some. So after going through all that, we know that Ta'as speaks of provoking anger, of agitating and stirring up anger in someone. But the nuance that gets lost in the English translations is that this anger is leading to an action. So it's not just that he's angered. He's angered to the point that it will lead to this action. And that's what's important is, and that's the nuance that gets completely lost. So. Yeah, you have to examine it for that. So next I'll examine the stems, moods, and tenses, if any, applied. So, once I get an understanding of the work, that's when we get into the grammar part. And so here I find it described in the Hiphil stem. So to understand the Hiphil stem, and some of these I've kind of, Hiphil I see a lot, so I don't tend to look this one up every time because I kind of got where I know that one. But initially, early on, I didn't. So I would turn to it's the Glossary of Morphosynaptic Database Terminology. So that's where I go for my definition. It was part of my Logos package. I love it, though.
Okay.
Like I said, that's the one I use for that. And then there's another one that'll actually tell you how to tell whether it is in the Hiphil stem and what that means. Yeah, I didn't include that in this study, but if you look on my site again, I list all the books in there that I use.
Oh, do you? So. Okay, good. Good, good.
Yeah, but so for this one, you know, I pull it up and it tells me, you know, in biblical Hebrew, stems refer to the relationship of the verb subject to the action of the verb. That is, the stem conveys grammatical voice relationships. The hyphal stem indicates the causative sense of a verb. That is, the subject of the verb in the hyphal stem causes the object of the verb to participate in the action of the verb as a sort of under-subject or secondary subject. So the example they give is in the sentence, Bob caused the car to crash. The direct object, car, participates in the action that the subject, Bob, caused. So in this case, it means Yisrael is provoking the anger in Yahweh. Yeah, Yahweh is the one being angered, but Yisrael is causing that anger.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the Hiphol tells us. Had there been any other grammatical nuances in the word, I would have looked them up in the Glossary of Morphosyntactic Database Terminology as well. But in this case, there were none. There were no tenses applied to it and no moods. So it wasn't in any volitional mood, and it wasn't in any tenses. So it was just a straight-out word.
Gotcha.
So moving on, we are told that we get told what was provoking Yahweh's anger. And it was because of those idols and images. Now, pastil here is a simple word. It speaks of graven or carved images. Anything that is believed to be or to represent a god. And I got that definition going through that same exact process. I went through all those books together in this pretty much the same order. And, you know, to me, big crosses, statuaries, and adorning churches today, that's a pastil. And he continues to further describe why he's angry with Habel Nakar. I think this is kind of just redefining or pointing out the same thing, because Nakar and Pasil are very similar words, but with slight nuances.
Mm-hmm.
So in Hebrew, adjectives follow nouns. You know, Craig's talked about this before. You know, you don't say red wagon, it'd be wagon red.
Mm-hmm.
So Nakar, yeah, when you translate it into English, you would reverse the two. So while in Hebrew it was, Nakar, Habel Nakar, in English we would render it as Nakar Habel. So Nakar is an adjective modifying Habel. And Nakar is a simple word. It speaks of that which is foreign. The DBL defines it as a foreign. Go ahead.
No, I didn't find that right away. I had to dig a little deeper to find that it was called as foreign gods. I mean, obviously they would be. They wouldn't be. You know, everything is foreign. It's not Yahweh. But
yeah.
He's making a real good point that if you're that they've now become the same as all their enemies. You know, they've adopted all their gods. I mean, this is. We know this. I mean, it's mentioned all the time, but I mean, it's being very, very clear. You went over there and became like them, stole their gods, and now you're making your own statues and your own sculptures and your own things to worship. So, but
there are several points where Yahweh refers to Yisrael as Goyim, which
yeah.
your Yisrael is pretty much the most damning thing he can say to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's the same way, though. As Goyim, once we become part of the covenant, we become Yisrael.
Right.
But once they reject the covenant, they become Goyim.
Yeah, not a good choice.
So the Dictionary of Biblical Languages defines Nakar as foreign land or a foreigner. The Theological Word Book reinforces this, as do all the other lexicons. Habel is another Hebrew word for idol. So, since Yahweh chose to use Pasel and Habel in the same sentence, it's incumbent upon us to pay attention and examine its nuances. And Pasel was a fairly simple word. I mean, you know, graven or carved images. That's about all you can get from it. But Habel is a little more in-depth. And interestingly, Habel is actually the name of Abel.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been Habel. So again, we'll turn to the Dictionary of Biblical Languages, where we read, idol, i.e., a fashioned object with a focus on its lack of value, meaningless, emptiness, futility, uselessness, i.e., what is of no use on the basis of it being futile and lacking in content. breath or vapor, i.e. unit of air that passes in and out of the lungs through the mouth and nostrils, with a focus on its briefness and lack of content. Vocalized differently, but spelled the same, we find it can mean be worthless, useless, i.e. to lack value. Talk worthlessly. Speak content with which has little or no value. Be proud, i.e. have an improper haughtiness as a moral failure, with a focus that the object of one's pride is worthless and of no value, implying a trust in said object. To feel with false hope, i.e. mislead a person to a false view or opinion, and so have an empty, worthless hope. See how this is a little bit more nuanced than Priscilla was?
Mm-hmm. I think.
So then I turn to the theological word book again. And okay. This is where it gets a little interesting because you learn it talks about the origin. So it says, vapor, breath, or vanity. The substantive is translated almost exclusively by the KJV as vanity, except for the passages in Ecclesiastes where the RSV concurs with the KJV. The RSV generally leads to the translation breath or worthless. The noun appears 71 times in the Old Testament. 36 times it is used in Ecclesiastes, where it occurs at least once in each of the 12 chapters, except chapter 10. So, you know, there's a whole lot there about, you know, what the KJV and the RSV rendered it. I don't care. Going on, the proper name Abel, the second son of Adam, is also written Havel. Whether or not there is a connection between this and the substantive under discussion is another matter. Most of the Hebrew lexicons have connected Abel with the cognate Akkadian word ablu, or aplu, son. One will note that Abel is named in Genesis 4 without any explanation, a fact that can hardly be without significance since almost all the proper names in the Genesis account are explained by assonance. The basic meaning of Havel is wind or breath. This is illustrated best in Isaiah 57:13. The wind will carry them off, a breath will take them away. So the wind was Ruach and breath was Havel. And Proverbs 21:6, the getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor, Havel Nidap. The word Nidap, meaning to drive, is most often used in connection with the wind as a driving force. There are three basic categories or contexts in which Havel is used. First, it is used as a designation for false gods worshipped by the people of God, and hence is usually translated in context by the RSV as idols. See Deuteronomy 32:21, Kings 16:13 and 26, 2 Kings 17:15, Jeremiah 2:5 and 8:19, paralleled to Passel, that's the one we're talking about now, Jeremiah 10:8. And 5:51, 18, John 2:8, and Psalms 31:6. Secondly, the term represents the individual and sometimes exasperating sentiments of individuals. Isaiah 49:4, where the servant of Israel says, "I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing in vanity." Job complains about the brevity and uncertainty of his life, 7:16. The similar idea is in the Psalter, Psalm 39:5, 6, 11. And I'm not going to read all these citations because it just would take too long.
That's okay.
In which Havel is...
You're going to post this so everybody can read it?
Yeah, it'll be posted.
All right.
So, hence, Havel seems to mean here short-lived. Third is the cluster of references found in Ecclesiastes. These may be grouped into several subdivisions. First are those passages in which the author states his inability to find fulfillment in work, both in his failure to be creative and his lack of control over the privilege of free disposition of his possessions. This is vanity. Second are those verses in which the author struggles with the idea that the connection between sin and judgment, righteousness, and final deliverance is not always direct or obvious. This is an anomaly about life, and it is vanity. The meaning of Havel here would be senseless. Thirdly are those verses in which the author laments the shortness of his life. This is vanity. Life is a, in its quality, is empty or vacuous, and thus unsubstantial, and the quantity is transitory. Rather than the above observations being final conclusions about life by the author of Ecclesiastes, perhaps they reveal something of this method and its concealed premise. He may be attempting to demonstrate man's inability to find meaning to life innated by divine revelation and interruption. This solo quest will always end in futility. So that's a long wondering. The theological word book can be very long and wordy, but there's a lot of little things to be gleaned from
it. Good stuff.
So upon inspecting
applies to Abram, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
He didn't have much of a shot before his brother killed him.
That would be a perfect reason why he would have been named that. Yeah, if, mm-hmm. The whole
yeah.
breath or vapor to being something that was right. short-lived and ultimately meaningless.
Yeah.
And that describes most lives.
Yeah.
So upon inspection of the other lexicons, they all concur with the vapor breath definition as well as enforcing the fleeting nature of the word. So it speaks of idols as being worthless, meaningless, and empty. The Bell Macar combined tells us that these idols were adopted from foreign people and that they are worthless to us and provide false hope. Can you think of any graven images and idols that were adopted from foreign people that provide false hope and people love to boast and praise in them?
Gosh, we've got crosses, we've got, you name it, man. We've got statues of everybody. Everybody under the sun has made me into a god. They, you go to Rome, you've got steeples. Gosh, you got paintings all over the place. I mean, it's hard for me to go to museums
all
now.
All the Catholic icons.
Yeah, Catholic icons, my gosh. Everybody's wearing little crosses around their neck or even the Greek Orthodox, they have their little double cross thing. You can't go anywhere without it.
I went to go to the store today after work to pick up some dog food, and as I'm walking in, there's a guy set up on the side with this huge rack of ornate crosses.
Really? Yeah.
It was sickening. Yeah, that was actually something interesting is, because I ended up having to go through most of the beginning of chapter 10, which, you know, just so happened to be, I hit that while I was at home on my Christmas break. And for those who haven't read Jeremiah chapter 10 or don't remember it exactly, that's where it speaks of going into the woods and cutting down a tree and bringing it into your home
and
decorating it
with paint.
So I just so happened to be translating that right around Christmas time, which that was one of those, like, I'd read through before, but I'd never translated. And I knew it was going to be damning to Christmas and, you know, Christianity in that regard. When I got into that, it is so much more damning than I ever expected.
Mm-hmm.
And when you examine the word used for tree, it's not just speaking of a tree. It's any object made of wood.
Yeah.
And you just look at how many of these churches have these ornate crosses, wooden crosses decorated with all their gold and silver. You can't help but see it. And as you go through the whole section I do here in Jeremiah 4, I went through a whole section, and it kept bringing up, if you read it in English, it's speaking of trees and mountains. Well, in Hebrew, the word for tree was preceded with the definite article ha. So it was the tree, and
the tree.
It wasn't mountains, it was rocks, and it was the rock. Well, can you think of a religion that has a wooden icon as its symbol and a religion that has a rock at its core?
Islam, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right, actually, as I was going through that, there's just so much in that. And like I said, the English, they completely ignore the definite article on those words and thus make it into an almost nonsensical statement. Whereas when you examine it as a single into, a specific thing, you get a whole nuance to it and you understand something now.
Now, when you go through stuff like this and you get the overall gestalt of what he's saying, don't you just get angry sometimes? And they have to purposely do this. You're not a scholar. You're a heck of a lot better at this than I am. But I can figure out most of this stuff on what is really being said. You build a heck of a case just in this 8-9 pages stuff is amazing. Why can't they? So it's got to be purposeful.
I've come across where I'm like, I literally think it's laziness. Because, you know, there's a lot of times where I'll come across where a word isn't used. And trying to figure out, you know, once you use that word, it starts not making sense. So you have to, I have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what's being said. It's like, I see why they just dropped that word and decided to go with it. They were just lazy, almost.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it's repetition because you write your book and you write all this stuff and you don't have to. But somewhere along the line, somebody had to get a team of experts together and they said, okay, we're going to make a lexicon and we're going to publish that, da, 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 and let's go through our stuff. And they surely had to go through all this too and do the same type of stuff and say, didn't anybody turn around and say, well, wait a minute, that ain't what this means. And apparently not, or they must not have a conscience at all.
Well,
else you have to be, or you just do it for the money, and you don't care whether any of this stuff is true or not.
I think that's the case. I think most of especially the higher up of religious organizations. I think most of them don't even believe in a God. They're using it as a payday.
Yeah.
It's their way of getting money, power, and fame. I can't think that they actually, know the truth. Even I think they just. They know they have to know they're lying, and they have to know to justify doing it. Yeah, how many of them I would say know the truth versus are just lying to lie? I don't know, but like I say, I can't see how anyone could know the truth and choose to reject it.
Yeah. Well, you live in Christian country, like I did down in the South. I mean, I think once you grew up in that, it's such a calling because everybody has such high respect for preachers and church people that and evangelists and mission work people, and that the calling is to be well respected and to do something for God, for your religion, and then they never really you can't question that because then the whole house of cards falls apart. And then what do you do? Then your mama don't speak to you, and your friends treat you, they shun you. I know people like that.
Like, especially if you live like in the Bible Belt, you learn that for so many of these people, it's a cultural thing. They're not religious in a sense of like they're sitting there studying the Bible and they know it. Yeah, they're going to church because that's just what's expected, and they know they're going to get dirty looks if they don't, and it's part of socializing and.
Yeah, it's good business, too.
Community building and network. Yeah, networking. That's the thing. I don't talk to people about this before. Yeah, anytime I see a small business with a fish logo on their thing, I know I'm going to get screwed if I use them. They will. They will use that to get your trust because
I can't make a conclusion without a business. I ain't going to trust you guys.
Yeah. Well, I've seen that so many times. I got my mother-in-law continues to take her car to a mechanic that's her daughter's brother-in-law, and my brother-in-law used to use him too, and he was there one time getting some work done in his car, and I was at my mechanic getting work done, and he told me what he paid for what he got. I looked at my mechanic and go, what would you charge for this? It was literally less than half.
Wow.
But he was a good Christian, taking care of his family, and she continues to use him thinking that. And just that mindset, and so it's good for your business to be a Christian around here. Yeah, if you come out as an atheist or God forbid, following Yahweh around here, and you own a business, you're screwed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's mostly social. I mean, most people here, I don't think, are religious in the true sense of religious. They have no interest in it. It's just something they do because that's how they grew up.
Let me ask you something. Are we still recording? Because it's after 6 now. Is that we're still on air?
Yeah, it's still recording,
but we're not live, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. When on this you were looking for the context at 8:18 and 8:19 of Yirmiyah in order to get to 9:25 and 26. Now, I started at 9:25 and 26, and I went back and just glanced over so I wouldn't seem too ignorant about 8:18 and 8:19. But when you read 9:25 and 26, he's talking about a very specific day about Jerusalem or the Yudim, and they've adopted everything. He's calling the same thing as as Mithraim and Moabites and on and on and on and on. It's that day, to me, when I look through all those words, it appears to be, to me, it just screams out that it's not Yom Kippur, but this would be the day of the Magog War, not the Megiddo War with the Chinese Christians as we think it's going to be now. But this was the Islamic War. Is that what you got out of that on 9/25 and 26, or did you go back to it and get into it yet?
I haven't gotten to the commentary on it yet, but that was kind of my view. It didn't seem like this was speaking, like you said, of Yom Kippur. It's at a point sometime before that.
Yeah, but it did seem, because, you know, these words have so many little nuances, and I kept going through it, and I said, you know, he's talking about Muslims. And he's talking about, and you lift them all, and you go back through them, and this is Ishmael's children. This is Esau's children. This is Lot's children. And those are all Islamic nations now.
Yeah.
Islamic descendants. And they're going to get wiped out at the first one, the first World War III, as we like to call it, but, you know, on the Magog War. So that's not the same as the Chinese or Asian invaders that come in that are, as we think they're not going to be. They're going to be predominantly Christian-oriented or Christian-motivated with the growth of Christianity in China. But I was kind of leaning toward that, so I'd be interested to see when you get into a little bit what you, if you agree, because it just seems to cry out to me that that's the Magog War that he's referring to.
Yeah. I can definitely see that. Right, no, it definitely doesn't seem to be indicating the Yom Kippur.
Sign of lack. No.
Yeah.
I didn't think so either. Okay. But every time you see a Yom and you're in prophecy, and if we're talking about some mass destruction, you're either talking about something that we know about through the Torah that's already been written up, or the future events. That seems to be the biggies. So, just curious.
Yeah. And it's definitely not a past event, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm impressed with your stuff. That's good, man.
I appreciate it. That's been a
that's really good.
Long time coming, and I kind of got going on it and work on it every chance I get now. So I'm hoping once I get the mole chapter done, I want to go back and do a little bit of tweaking, read through it, but then I was going to send it out to like you, Craig, and a handful of others to kind of do an editorial pass on it and see if I catch all my spelling errors and see if I'm way off on some things. And then I was going to publish that out on the website before, I don't want to wait until the whole book's done because I don't know how long it's going to take me to do the next part. But I actually want to have three parts to it. I want to have a whole section on Mool, a whole section on Aral, and then I got my brother-in-law, who's a doctor, is going to help me do a whole section on the medical aspect of circumcision. And do a whole section on that, talking about the medical benefits and realities of it. So,
the one thing I didn't talk about.
A little ambitious on this one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just saying I got a little ambitious on this one, so I've got a lot planned for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to it. When we started our discussion, the one thing I left out, and I assume you use that as well, is I forgot to tell people that one of the good investments is to get the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible as well. So when you're reading the Masoretic text, you can go and see whether it's actually available to them in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So you can tell whether they're improvising. So if you run across something every once in a while in the Masoretic, you find something and you really can't prove it one way or the other. And then you go to the Dead Sea Scrolls and find out it's not, that verse can't even be found beyond the 11th century stuff, you know. So
I actually use the one I keep with me, and I'll use that to check whether there's a difference. And then I actually bought a while back, there's a Dead Sea Scrolls database for logos, so I can actually pull it up as my word-by-word breakdown in my exegetical guide. And it'll actually do the same thing as breaking it down and tell me the tenses and all that. So rather than having to look at, because with the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, it's great because it points out in italics everything that's different and then tells you what the differences are, but it's still a translation. So with this, I can actually pull it up and go, okay, well, what is that word? Okay, you know, it was just the plural form or this, but where it was this word or that, I can look it up and see the nuances in that regard. But that one, I got lucky. I pre-ordered that when it first came out for like $70. I think it's like $180 now.
Wow. It's expensive to get that. Well, if I had,
I think I've got about $700-$800 invested in my logos package at this point, but that's been over a decade's worth of purchases here and there, and just as I come across something new, or I get daily emails from them about stuff, and every now and then I'll be like, okay, well, that's a good deal, I'll buy that. And,
but do me a favor.
You can get into. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I walked with someone through it because they don't have the original languages package anymore, which is what I started with. But that contains so much just junk. I mean, it has some great resources. But I think when I was walking someone through it to get everything I got now, just buying it individual book by book, I think it was, he said he was looking at like $600, $650. So to get all the resources I use. So. It's not too bad to get into.
It's not too bad.
If I know how to use it. So, that's the first thing. It did take me several, months of just playing around in there and watching a ton of YouTube videos of people using it, and then, just kind of figuring it out and toying with it. But I'm kind of a techie guy. I love computers, and I love, I can pick up on a lot of that pretty quick. So, it's worth for me.
Dude, sometimes when you really don't have much to do and you have a moment, if you can, send me an email on what I really need that I'm missing on grammar and stuff like that. As goes as our conversation tonight, because that I hate to be so ignorant in that, and I'm not of such a big aspect, and it's so hard to put it together. I just don't have a source that says I need somebody to say, okay, that is Hipple, whatever.
That's where I've gotten to where it's like, I love logos for that because it does all that hard work for me. Because otherwise, I'd be going, okay, what is this word? Okay, this is the root word. So it's got this doubled and it's got this added. What is that again? And it would take me forever and a day to do anything if I didn't have the little cheats down there.
Yeah.
But here, I might let you go. So. I'm starting to lose my voice.
Okay, buddy, that was great fun. I enjoyed it very much.
Oh, yeah, I had a great time. So I'll talk with you next week.
All right. See you later.
Bye.